It is 8:30, and we have with us John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
No Maria this week.
No, she was hit by a stray missile from the White House.
Yeah, that was
that was an ugly incident. No, she's out. She was a little swamped by work this week, and mm-hmm. Hopefully we'll be back next week. But
we're keeping our fingers crossed.
We are keeping our fingers crossed. We will definitely miss her, but we will forge on because let's face it, there was enough yucky going on in the world this week to keep us all busy. So
yeah. Thank goodness for that.
Yeah, that's right. There's no shortage of material to work with.
There isn't. So let's dive into that. Right at the beginning of the week, the 9/11 Commission had before it a stellar lineup of people, one of them being Mr. Richard Clark.
Yes, there were actually quite a few stars there, including members of both the past Clinton and Bush administration. And it's helpful to remind ourselves why we had all of these important people appearing all at once. It's because of the Bush administration's insistence that the report of the final report of the commission be done by the May deadline that was specified in the original congressional legislation. The panel was repeatedly delayed because of White House stonewalling, and then it asked for an extension so as to complete their work more fully, and that extension was denied. And so the panel has been faced with trying to incorporate an enormous amount of testimony, an enormous amount of information into some sort of a cohesive whole as a final report between now and May. And so this is why you had these public hearings that were all being crammed together like this. And, you know, with the exception of the testimony around Clark, really you had the panel operating in a fairly bipartisan manner the entire time. We even had our own Slade Gordon, for example, putting Donald Rumsfeld over the coals early this week, which was something we hadn't really gotten used to seeing with the Skeletor's public career over the years. Here is his being relatively nonpartisan, but you saw him questioning Rumsfeld, the administration party line, of course, in response to Clark, being that, well, we were going to develop this massive plan to a much tougher plan to combat al-Qaeda and combat terrorism. And that's what we were working on when we came into the White House, and it was going to take 7 months to do that, and then the plan itself was going to involve 3 years of escalating diplomatic pressure against the Taliban in Afghanistan. And Gordon asked him, what made you think, given all of the briefings of the White House and given all of the insistent intelligence information that al-Qaeda was getting ready to strike, that you had even 7 months to play with, let alone 3 years. So there was fairly fierce questioning of both the Clinton and the Bush officials, but we've seen a real politicization, is I think the word, of the testimony with Richard Clark. And we've seen also, I think, a real buck passing. Probably the most important thing that Clark did out of all of his testimony, and the most remarkable thing, I thought it was fairly profoundly moving, was the very simple words of, I apologize. Your government failed you. I failed you. And saying that to the families of the victims of 9/11, this is something that we have not heard from George Bush. We have not heard from any of the senior officials of the Bush administration actually taking responsibility and saying the buck stops here. I had a column that appeared in Working for Change, and a version of it will be in Seattle Weekly next week, that basically talked about the unanswered questions, the things that weren't being asked that were fairly obvious in this panel. And one of them, of course, is why did it take 2 years to get around to investigating 9/11 when you could turn around U.S. foreign policy on a dime? You know, we invaded Afghanistan, we passed Patriot Act, we gutted the Constitution, we tried to convince the whole world to invade Iraq with us, and when that failed, we invaded Iraq anyway. We could do all that, but we couldn't actually investigate the single incident that supposedly made all of this necessary. So we had that, but we also had the question of why did no heads roll after 9/11? You should have had the head of the CIA, the head of the FBI, Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, you know, all of those people. You would have thought that some or all of them would have been fired just on general principle for having not seen this coming, for not having actually protected the administration. Of course, there are other questions also. You know, how does a plane skate in and plow into the Pentagon? Isn't there a defense for that? You know, nobody's really addressed that question.
Over an hour after they'd seen the other ones go into
Exactly. It's been two hours since all heck broke loose, and you know, you knew you had four airplanes hijacked. Don't they have like interceptor jets or missiles or something? You know, is the Department of Defense too busy invading places to worry about actually defending? You want to ask about how much the war in Iraq has been a distraction from actually going after al-Qaeda, and you know, how much it's inflamed anti-Muslim terror and all the. So there's lots of things that the commission has not had the opportunity to ask or has not been politically expedient to ask, maybe is a way to do it.
Yeah.
But when you have somebody standing up and taking responsibility, as Clark has said, and saying that there are other people within the administration that also failed, which, you know, is obvious to any thinking person in this country that you know, somebody fell on the job somewhere for something like of that scale to happen, you have this massive right-wing campaign and this massive administration campaign to discredit one of the people who has, you know, served through three Republican administrations, five administrations total, is a registered Republican. And we've had this portrait of the administration now from Clark, from Joe Wilson, from Paul O'Neill, the former Treasury Secretary, from all of these people who are fairly mainstream, often Republican staff people or high-level administrators who served in the inner circles of the Bush administration, painting the same picture, painting the picture of a security apparatus that was obsessed with Iraq from the day it came into office, that was convinced it had all the answers, did not have any kind of internal debate, did not have any kind of discussion of what was and wasn't correct. They didn't want to be bothered with the facts because they thought they had all the answers already. And this is the portrait that we're getting from any number of sources now, not just Richard Clark, of how the Bush administration works. And it really is kind of sobering to consider what they could do with another 4 years. So that really is the bottom line of why you've had this credit campaign to discredit Clark, because it is an election year, and because the Bush administration, I think, is very concerned that Americans are starting to put two and two and two together and coming up with the portrait of how this White House functions and how it makes decisions, because it's a really irresponsible and a really frightening way to make decisions when you've got the most powerful job in the world.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's a good thing to continue with the current commission, which, you know, as you said, is supposed to be ending or wrapping up in May. I mean, they've got, as a comparison, they've got all of $14 million for funding on their venture so far, whereas you look at something like Whitewater that went into 40-some million of public funding. And
6 or 7 years. I mean,
yeah, or the NASA shuttle, you know, disaster.
Yeah,
which,
Columbia.
$50 million, and they immediately got on it, you know. So, like you say, I don't think they've gotten into nearly the detail on this commission that they should be going into. So I don't know whether people should be demanding that the commission continue, or they just, you know, shut that one down and then start like a real one, you know.
Well, I at this point, this is probably the best, even though it was the White House that actually selected the members of this commission. You know, this is what we've got right now. And I think this is the vehicle through which people, you know, if you want a better investigation of 9/11, it has to start with the White House. It has to start with people like Condoleezza Rice being willing to testify under oath. It has to start with, you know, the people who actually made the decisions in the days and weeks and months leading up to and after 9/11 actually being willing to testify openly and on the record about what, you know, what honestly their decisions were, so as to repeat something like, you know, not repeat something like this happening in the future. That is the goal here. It's not to assess blame. It's to assess what happened so as to ensure that it doesn't happen again. And unfortunately, that's being subverted by politics. And we've seen in this White House a real eagerness to not accept responsibility for what happens on its watch.
Another one of the people that is in question, the executive director of the commission, Philip Zelico, who turns out was actually in on some of the meetings prior to this happening.
There's a real question of conflict of interest with him.
Because so a lot of people, a lot of the victims' families are asking for him to step down and or else he should be pulled
from
the whole
thing. He's insisting that, well, I've recused myself from all areas of the investigation, that he was involved in the transition team also in the Bush administration. And he's saying he's recusing himself, but a lot of the victims' families are saying that that's not adequate. And a lot of the victims' families are really upset with how this whole commission has been laid out, and particularly upset with the White House and with the Bush administration for its stonewalling.
In fact, a lot of where the commission did get its teeth on its questioning and the people it's pulled in came from those very families pushing them to do that.
Yes, very, so. Very much so. And from the fact that those families had moral authority in a way that public officials don't, because they're clearly not motivated by partisan politics. They're clearly motivated by, you know, having been drafted by through a horrible tragedy into being in the middle of this, and you know, they deserve our admiration and thanks, because without their efforts we probably wouldn't be getting as much as we're getting.
So, and along those lines, some of those family members will be part of a piece we're going to be playing tomorrow morning, the 9/11 Citizen Watch press conference that happened this last Monday. We'll be starting that at 6:30 a.m. tomorrow morning, from 6:30 to 8 a.m. So if you want to hear what the rest of the networks didn't cover, tune in then. Let's move on to, speaking of terrorism, there was an assassination this week, at least one, in Palestine, Israel.
Yeah, an important assassination, although there were actually several other people that were killed in the missile attack also, is the Israeli assassination of the person who is described as the spiritual leader of Hamas, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, who is actually the founder of Hamas, which was an assassination that is by far the highest level assassination that's been carried out by the Israeli government of someone amongst the Palestinian resistance. Yassin was the founder of Hamas. He was an elderly, blind quadriplegic, confined to a wheelchair, who has instantly been elevated to martyr throughout the Arab world. We saw enormous demonstrations, some 200,000 in Gaza City, and similar demonstrations in Arab capitals all across the Arab world, marking his funeral after the assassination. And we also saw a significant escalation in the inevitable cycle of retribution and threats of retribution to be carried out against the Sharon government. The opinion really in almost all of the Arab world is that this important an escalation by the Israeli government, this kind of action, which was, you know, clearly seen as something that is going to make a peace process impossible for the foreseeable future. You know, Hamas, to a lot of Palestinians, has credibility in the way that the Palestinian Authority never has, because the Palestinian Authority, once it was created through the Oslo Accords, really Yasser Arafat surrounded himself with a lot of his own thugs. There was a lot of corruption. It was really seen as his own show. And you've had a real emasculation of Arafat over the past couple of years, that he's been, you know, confined in the basement of essentially what is a headquarters that has now been reduced to rubble, and the Palestinian Authority really has also been reduced to rubble. At the same time, Hamas has filled a lot of the functions that the Palestinian Authority never did. It's not just an organization that sends out suicide bombers. It is also an organization that provides a significant amount of financial aid to the poor and the indigent in the West Bank and in Gaza. And remember that an important part of the entire Israeli-Palestinian dynamic is economic, that Israel has a cheap labor force in the best of times, certainly, and that there is tremendous unemployment in the worst of times, because Palestinians can't get to their jobs across closed borders, so that you have really an entire people that is not just a bunch of refugees that have been living under a military occupation for 35 years, but also that are being kept alive really through foreign aid in the United Nations and organizations like Hamas that help out people that need that kind of help. So they have a lot of credibility that way. And Sheikh Yassin had a lot of credibility in that way, because Hamas has been helpful to a lot of people amongst the Palestinians. At the same time, because it's seen as such an escalation, the sense on the street, and this is true throughout the Arab world, is that level of a decision by the Israeli cabinet, and they have said that they made that decision about a week before the assassination was carried out, is widely believed that assassination could not have happened without the at least indirect blessing of George Bush and of the American government. And so in the aftermath, as you had the threats of retribution, you had for the first time in a number of years not only Hamas but also terrorist groups associated with Al-Qaeda and a number of other terrorist organizations throughout the Arab world and throughout the Islamic world threatening retribution against the United States as well. Because the United States is now being held accountable along with Israel for what is by almost any measure been the longest running military occupation of a people in modern history, really, is certainly in the last couple of generations. The United States has been really spared the anger that has been directed at Israel by advocates for Palestine, because the United States was seen as really the only possible arbiter of any kind of a potential peace process, so that, you know, people didn't want to target American targets with the suicide bombers, with the terrorist attacks. Now that a peace process appears to be out the window, and with the belief that there is tacit U.S. U.S. approval for the assassination of Sheikh Yassin, you know, we're at risk now too. Not just because of our actions in Iraq, but also our actions or lack of actions in Israel-Palestine. And we've said on this program many times that the lack of Bush administration action in and with regards to Palestine, and it's really free reign that it has given to Ariel Sharon, have done much more to increase the terrorist danger than anything that we have, that we've done or could not do in Afghanistan or Iraq. That really is central to the entire question of U.S. security at this point and preventing terrorism around the world. And I think we're one step closer to seeing that vision bear fruit in an unfortunate way this week. And that really was one of the key developments in that assassination this week.
Yeah, I'm not sure bearing fruit would be the proper analogy.
Well, it's rather unfortunate fruit, but
All right, moving along. Last week we talked about what was going on in the Pakistani border region between Pakistan and Afghanistan, and
speaking of the war on terror and trying to round up militants.
And this week it continued.
Yeah, and has really devolved into something of a fiasco. It's fairly clear at this point that the supposed high value targets that the Pakistani army, had surrounded in the mountains between the tribal areas of Pakistan in the mountains near the border of Afghanistan, that anybody that was there has long gone. That they are not in the cordon any longer, and they have discovered several networks of tunnels through which folks like that could have escaped. But at the same time, we also talked how many of the people who had been taken prisoner by the Pakistani army, who had been killed by the Pakistani army, were simply tribespeople. Were people who had a great deal of independence and freedom from the central Pakistani government over the years, and who now are having their autonomy threatened by the Pakistani army. Well, we had a situation over the past week where those tribespeople have taken a number of soldiers hostage, and some of the paramilitaries in the region hostage. Several of the, I believe, eight of the Pakistani soldiers were found dead yesterday. And The government of Musharraf now is getting it from both sides. They're getting it from people in the army who are saying that the entire operation that the Pakistani army has undertaken in the region has been a fiasco, that it's been very poorly organized, that it's failed in its objectives. But you're also getting it from the Islamists and from the tribes people who often have not worked together in the past, but who are now united in their denunciations of essentially the attacks upon the autonomy of the independent regions in the northwest frontier. You're seeing the Pakistani army using some of the same techniques, actually, that the Israelis have used in the West Bank, where they're bulldozing houses of people who are accused of having harbored militants at some point. You're getting a number of accusations of human rights abuses against these tribes, people who have done nothing more than been at the wrong place at the wrong time. Between those two, between the unrest and the murmurings that are going on in the within the military, which is Musharraf's biggest constituency. Remember, he came out of being a general and taking power in a military coup d'état. Between that on the one side and the demonstrations and the unrest amongst some of the tribes people and amongst some of the Islamists on the other, it's posing a real threat to the government of Musharraf at this point. And there's also a belief that, similar to the assassination attempts on him in December, where he survived a couple of different assassination attempts, that something like that may be brewing again at this point because of the botched operations in the northwest. And it has become very clear also that Musharraf's the one force that he is working very closely with is the United States. The entire operation was launched 3 days before Colin Powell showed up in Pakistan. He's being accused on all sides of having essentially auctioned Pakistan off to the Americans, because this has really been the first time, after 9/11, Musharraf began working with the U.S. military, and it's really been the first time in a number of years that that's been the case. And that's incredibly unpopular in much of the Islamic world right now, and so once again we're seeing that turn into something of a powder keg. And of course, as we talked about last week, there continues to be a great deal of sustained fighting on the Afghanistan side of the border as well.
Yeah, he's walking a very fine line there. It's been very unstable for quite a while, and just the regular people that Pakistanis can see evidence of the United States' control of the situation there by just going to the local airports, where we just had Jeff Siddiqui on the show last week.
Yeah.
And he reported when he was in Pakistan, there was a new addition to all the airports. There's video cameras in all the airports. And do the video cameras go to Pakistani intelligence? No, they're beamed up via satellite to the FBI.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, all right. Well,
And people in Pakistan are very aware of that.
Yeah, and they're not too happy. Let's move along. We only got just over 5 minutes left. Give us an update on what's going on in this week in Iraq.
Well, we certainly don't have. We certainly couldn't wrap it up in 5 minutes. It's been another bloody week in Iraq. A number of soldiers have died this week. I believe we had 16 people die just yesterday. One U.S. soldier and a number of others, mostly around Fallujah. West of Baghdad, we'd had several other U.S. soldiers die in various areas earlier this week. Several important political developments that I want to get to first. However, we had early this week Sheikh Ali al-Sistani, who's the Sunni cleric who has really led the opposition to the U.S. imposition of a new constitution and elections and the whole June 30th handover. He and his office delivered a letter to the United Nations early this week, essentially threatening that his followers, which is really the Shiite majority, I think I said Sunni, but Shiite, I was thinking Sunni triangle because I was thinking Fallujah, but the Shiite majority within Iraq really would be willing to shut Iraq down if the United Nations endorses or grants any kind of legitimacy to the constitution that the Iraqi National Congress passed over Shiite objections a couple of weeks ago, and that we talked about on this program. This again is a real escalation and really kind of a drawing of line in the sand where. The Americans don't really have a whole lot of allies within Iraq right now. You have al-Sistani and the largest Shiite civil organizations saying we will shut the country down if this constitution is adopted, if the United Nations recognizes this constitution as being legitimate. You have really fierce fighting going on, particularly within the Sunni triangle. We had a number of skirmishes in the Fallujah area this week because the U.S. Marines came back in and for the first time in a number of weeks attempted to exert direct control within Fallujah. And this is one reason why we haven't had as many casualties among the U.S. military the past several weeks. We've seen a shifting towards soft targets and toward Iraqi policemen and other collaborationists by the resistance in the past several weeks, but also we've seen that lower death toll. I'm sorry, because the Marines and the Army of the United States has pulled back from a number of the key areas. Well, we saw the Marines going back into Fallujah this week, and they've been attacked virtually every day that they've been in there. And there have been further attacks as well. There was an attack where a couple of people died in Kirkuk earlier this week. In Mosul, you had two people killed this morning, actually, when a rocket was fired at City Hall. You had in Basra earlier this week, an area of the country we haven't heard very much from in the south of the country, where the Brits have had control over Basra, where 14 British soldiers were injured in a mob that was protesting the joblessness, the lack of jobs within Iraq, and that protest became violent, essentially became a riot. The joblessness in Iraq approaching 80% at this point, which is one reason why you have so many people applying for these jobs as Iraqi policemen, even though many of them are getting shot at and killed by the resistance. It really has been a case over this past week where several soldiers have died, but a number more civilians have died. You know, anywhere between 12 and 20 on any given day this week, and at the same time, you have the provisional authority that has been ruling Iraq for Washington, trying to put a happy face on this and saying that the security situation is improving. People on the ground in Iraq aren't buying it. They don't believe it. And at the same time, as I say, you have very few allies on either side. You don't have Shiites saying that the Constitution is valid. You have Sunnis continuing to lead the resistance. You have unrest in the north of the country as well with the Kurds. It really is degenerating fairly rapidly in Iraq right now.
And I think one reason for the lower casualties is because the U.S. was bringing in fresh troops, so they're like pulling back from certain regions while they're doing that. You know,
yeah, because a lot of these troops haven't been adequately trained, and they're getting trained in the field, which is a really dangerous situation.
People like your local, you know, firemen and policemen,
people who are in the reserve and the National Guard who never thought they'd find themselves in the middle of a war zone. Yeah.
So we just have about a minute left. And so I'm going to give you 45 seconds to tell us about what happened in the House and Senate this week in regards to...
We had an important bill passed right around the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, which makes it a crime to injure a fetus. But more importantly, we've certainly had bills passed in the past that increase penalties for crimes against violent crime against pregnant women. But the language of the bill in this case defined a fetus, defined an unborn child as having the rights of a human being. A lot of this is seen as being an important predecessor to an undermining or an overturning of Roe v. Wade. And we had an important schism locally on this regard also, where George Nethercutt, the Spokane representative now running for U.S. Senate against Patty Murray, was a real lead in this legislation in the House. And Patty Murray was one of the leaders of trying to stop this legislation in the Senate. So we're going to be hearing a lot about abortion and about the rights of women to have reproductive freedom in this senatorial campaign coming up this fall.
Between now and November.
Yep.
Well, with that, we are out of time. Talking once again with John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And John, where do people find Eat the State?
It is a biweekly newspaper. You can find it at bookstores and cafes and other places where you find free periodicals. You can also find it on the web where all of our back issues are as well at www.eatthestate.org. It's all one word. And if you want to help out, want to contribute, because we always need your donations to keep printing, if you want to volunteer, if you have story tips or feedback on anything you hear on this program or see in the paper, give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-903-9461.